I don't know if any of you saw any of the Bourne films. You know, it was sort of violent escapist fantasy as far as I can work out. With Matt Damon as Jason Bourne in the sort of action-packed Bourne identity. A significant part of the plot was this highly trained assassin discovering who he was and staying alive long enough to do so. Amnesia, no memory, a case full of passports with different names, considerable resources being poured in to stop him discovering his true identity. No wonder, who am I? Was a question designed to confuse him. In real life, of course, we face the who am I question every day. And it's easy enough to answer at one level, isn't it? You know, I'm Hugh Palmer, I'm the husband of Claire, I'm the father of Anna, Lucy and Mark, and push me for more significance and I'll fall back on the usual safety net and assume the question means, what do I do? And tell you I'm the rector of all souls. We all tend to play various answers much like that. But life's got a way of confusing and destroying these levels of identity with various randomly different tools, doesn't it? You know, redundancy, retirement, illness, death, divorce. They can all leave me struggling with who am I? The actor Peter Sellers' biography was called The Mask Behind the Mask. And in it, the author writes that Sellers played so many different roles, he was sometimes not sure of his own identity. Approached once by a fan who asked him, "Are you Peter Sellers?" Sellers answered briskly, "Not today," and walked on. Well, I will find the deepest, richest, securest identity in this famous chapter at the beginning of John's Gospel. It looks at history. And it helps me look at myself through God's lenses. And right at the heart of it lies the verse that we'll be focusing on tonight, verse 12. I mean, this extraordinary prologue, the introduction to the gospel, centered on the Word and God's remarkable exercise in revealing himself, disclosing himself. The Word was spoken in creation, there in verse 3. The Word spoken in the Scriptures, verse 17, the Word spoken supremely, of course, in Jesus himself. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And what's it all leading up to? Well, it's there in verse 12. Yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. What's God up to? Planting the family of God in a world of darkness. That's what God's about. So that's what history's about. And to know myself a child of God, that is the profoundest privilege, the richest identity anyone could have. But there's not often a rush to claim it. I've called this really the unwanted identity. And you'll see why as you look at verses 9 to 12. They are extraordinary verses. And frankly, they undermine any idea that this is a made-up story. If we were going to make up the story of God coming to his world, his earth, it wouldn't run like this. You wouldn't make it up this way. Actually, it gives the lie to other ideas too. The thought that God doesn't care, and if only he cared a bit more, well, then we might follow him. Actually, the truth is, he does care. He cared enough to come into the world to rescue it, and when he did, well, we were the ones who couldn't be bothered. You see, look at verse 9. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. He was in the world, and though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. You know, it's not like you passing someone famous on Marylebone High Street and not recognizing them. I do it regularly and my family tells me who's just walked by and then I have to guess why I'm meant to know who they are. This is actually blanking someone you do know on the street. This is like explaining the design of All Souls to John Nash as if he were a tourist instead of the man who built the place. And it gets worse. Look at verse 11. He came to that which was his own. In the context, this must mean, I think, the Jewish people, the people he'd called out, the people he'd rescued, the people he'd kept, the people he'd guided, the people he'd revealed himself to, given his law to, the people he'd prepared for the coming Messiah. He came to that which was his own, and his own did not receive him. That's gutting, isn't it? And it wasn't a new feeling for God. Way back in the great Old Testament prophet Isaiah's day, he said, "All day long I've held out my hands to an obstinate people who walk in ways not good, pursuing their own imaginations. All day long I've held out my hands," as if he would welcome them, he would embrace them. You can sense the frustration, can't you? But his own did not receive him. There's actually a very British idea about this word receive. You may have come across it. Committees can receive a report. It's wonderful, really. It doesn't mean they agree with a word in it. Never mind they'll actually do anything about it. It just means they acknowledge it's there and someone wrote it. But it sounds good, doesn't it? We've received the report. Now, this doesn't even have that veneer of politeness. They turned their backs. They plotted against. They crucified him. We shouldn't sound too shocked, and we certainly shouldn't start pointing fingers. I mean, here in the UK, we've enjoyed the gospel for centuries. We've known its privileges. We've allowed it to shape our life, our culture, our laws. We've prided ourselves on them. But now? Well, at best, it seems we pay Christ lip service in the public square. At worst, we sneer or block our ears to anything he said. When Jesse Owens won his remarkable 4 gold medals at the 1936 Berlin Olympics, the story went round that Hitler was furious at a Negro winning so many golds at his Aryan Games, so he stormed out and refused to shake hands with him. There's some doubt about what actually went on in Berlin, but the truth is, when Owens got home, after a ticker tape parade through New York City in his honour, he went to a reception at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, also in his honour. But he was made to travel up to the reception in the service lift, not the guest lift, because he was black. He was never invited to the White House, and Jesse Owens said, "Hitler didn't snub me, Roosevelt did. The president never even sent me a telegram." Now, this is that, and far, far more, isn't it? He came to his own, but his own did not receive him. Yet, verse 12. Look at it. "Yet to all who did receive him," and the word is a strong one, it means to all who did take hold of him, Jesus, to those who believed in his name, his character, his person, and it's far more than a nodding of the head and a doffing of the cap in acknowledgement of Jesus. This faith is dynamic. There's a sense of movement. It's believed into his name. You know, it's that old illustration of standing at the bus stop and you see the bus there and you can believe that's your bus that'll take you home. Yeah, that's one thing. But getting onto it, that's believing into it. That's what'll actually get you there. Well, for those who'll be identified with Jesus like that, he gave the right to become children of God. This unwanted identity, it's the greatest privilege we can have. Edward, brought up, lived in North Sudan, came from a Muslim family, a devout Muslim family. He learnt the Quran by rote. One uncle turned to Christianity. It angered the whole family. They had him arrested for 5 years, jailed. Took his wife, children, all his possessions away from him. In doing this, they hoped to force him to return to Islam. "I was very angry," said Edward. "I tried to talk with him and help him to find his way back to Islam. So I decided to find out more about the Christian faith so as to be able to refute my uncle's arguments." He did find out more about the Christian faith. What he found out converted him. And Edward said this, "The decision for a life with Jesus changed my life totally. My mother soon noticed a difference in me, especially because I kept defending my uncle. She asked me if I too had become a Christian, and soon my whole family knew. My grandfather put pressure on my father to bring me back to Islam because it brought shame on our family that two members had now been lost. They decided not to have me arrested, but I still had to leave my parents' house immediately and sign a statement renouncing all claims I had as the oldest and only son to any kind of inheritance. I also had to drop out of university because, as a convert to Christianity, I no longer had any right to study there. My friends shunned me. It was very difficult for me to be and to live without family in a society where the family is of the utmost importance. And I had to learn to trust God totally. It was then," he says, "and it still is, a great comfort to me to know that though I no longer had an earthly family, I belong now to a much greater family and to a God whom I can call Father." The unwanted identity. That's the greatest privilege you can have. But as you look back at verse 12, let me show you something else about it. It is also not just an unwanted identity, it's what I call the universal right. A universal right. People are always offering salvation, aren't they? For some. You know, philosophies for the intelligent, mysticism for the initiated, religions for the moral. And the Jewish faith isn't the only one that seems centered on those from the right ethnic pedigree. So don't read verse 12 as if it's so normal it's like water off a duck's back. See, look what it says again. Yet to all. To all, regardless of age or gender or race or moral background. I mean, you've only got to turn one page and you come to chapter 3 and the story of Nicodemus, a Pharisee, a member of the Jewish ruling council, a respectable pillar of the religious in-crowd. And you turn one more page and you'll come to the Samaritan woman, the shady outcast, the morally as well as religiously dubious foreigner of chapter 4. So he means what he says in verse 12, yet to all who did receive him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. For a religion that's often thought of as exclusive, this is massively inclusive talk, isn't it? This universal right. And there's nothing flimsy about the right word. It's got a sense of certainty to it. This is the guarantee. We can be children of God. No, it's not a right we can demand like universal human rights. It's not ours just because we're human beings. Watch verse 13. Children born not of human descent. It's not in our genetic makeup. I mean, however Christian our parents or family are, they can't give us this right. Nor of human decision or a husband's will, whether it's a couple together saying, let's have children, or a husband calling the shots and says, we'll do it. We may be able to have children, but no one is naturally born a child of God. We hate it when things aren't in our control, don't we? We can't decide to make them, though. We can't produce children of God to order or by filling in the right paperwork. They are children, you see how verse 13 ends, born of God. That's why Jesus says to Nicodemus more than once, you must be born again, born from above. It's a life, a right, a status he gives to all who did receive him. To those who believed in his name, the right to become children of God. You see, in a world and a society where rank and status meant so much, and so many were slaves with so few rights and so little freedom, I mean, imagine having in your hands the right to be in personal relationship with, to be within the family circle of God Himself. The right to become children of God. It's no different today. I mean, every society has its haves and have-nots, whether it comes from class or caste or meritocracy or whatever. So many of us live under the shadow of how others value us or don't value us. It can be painfully true in the family, can't it? It can be very true at work. It can be tragically true even in church. The right to become children of God. I mean, look at it. Treasure it. Meet the put down with this identity. And for some of us, it's actually how we value ourselves that demoralizes and diminishes us. The crippling lack of self-worth some of us have, even some of us inside the Christian community. I wonder if we've learned yet one of the key secrets of discipleship, to preach to ourselves. You don't even have to be a great preacher to preach to yourself. To take a verse like verse 12. You know, to read it to myself. To repeat it to myself. To counter my negative thoughts. Other sneers with God's verdict on me. His promise to me as a believer. I am a child of God. And on the other hand, see, for those of us who have it all and still want more, you know, what greater security do I want than child of God? What greater status can I imagine than child of God? When our family, our education, our career assume a greater value for us and our ambitions for our children than the right to become children of God, we need to preach to ourselves as well. And we need to do it urgently. When you head off to work in the morning, when you enter the office, what identity do you take in with you? You know, manager, consultant, secretary, also ran? Or do you also think, and a child of God? Take that through the office doors. Actually, some heads are going to be lifted up and will serve better. Other heads will be humbled and will serve better. Students, when you head into the exam room later this term, remind yourself as you enter, I'm a child of God. It won't get you a better degree. Hard work between now and then might just pull that off. But this will keep your perspective and keep you sane. Yet to all who did receive it, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. You know, when people say casually, I'm not a believer, or actually these days often it's really quite smugly, even defiantly, I'm no believer. I look at this and I want to say to them, how tragic. Do you realize what you're missing out on? I met an archbishop from Fiji the other day. Well, I think he was an archbishop. I'm afraid it was at a conference and there were so many bishops and archbishops around. I never quite worked out to which one was which, but it's always better to give them the higher rank, isn't it? So we'll assume he was an archbishop. He'd been brought up a Hindu and a Brahmin Hindu at that. He grew up believing, he said, that he would need some, and I've forgotten what the figure was as to how many reincarnations it would take before he would be good enough for God. But it was easily a number, far more than handfuls, that meant, as he said, I had no chance of knowing God. I mean, imagine his delight, imagine his wonder at discovering he had the right to be a child of God and call God his father. He told of setting off from home with a rucksack on his back as a believer in Jesus, knowing the doors of his earthly family home would be shut to him. And in his, well, I couldn't work out whether it was really his faltering English or whether he had actually already mastered British understatement, but he said of revisionist voices in the Anglican Church, I get upset when people change the truth of who Jesus is. I imagine he does get upset when following this Jesus cost him so much? When his identity and security is bound up, not in being archbishop, but in the Jesus who's given him the right to become a child of God. Well, there are some in this church family who know the kind of extremes that Edward from the Sudan, the archbishop, have lived. For most of us, I suspect, life hasn't given us the same urgency about this right. So many of us as Brits, we've lived so long taking so many of our rights for granted, we assume they'll be there if we ever need them. And we treat the spiritual right the same way. It's there, it's filed away as one of those comforting promises in amongst a pile of spiritual baggage we carry around with us. The question tonight is, will we leave it like that? Or will we live it? Will we live it? Will it remain a vague comfort, or will we take it out and examine it and see it for the amazing privilege it is, the one right, the one identity I can take to the grave, and it'll still give me a future to look forward to? The right to become children of God. Now, won't you take a moment, just a moment now, to look again. I know the words are familiar. Let eye gate see it as well as ear gate. Face the promise. Pray that God's Spirit would root it in hearts and minds. So when the many, many voices we'll hear this week, some of them whispering that we're worth far less, some of them whispering that something else is far more important, this truth, this right, you and I hold on to. Let's take a moment to face it and ask the Spirit to root it in our hearts and minds.